Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the allegedly world's least corrupt country, according to Transparency's, the Corruption Perception Index, which was aptly named because the perception is not the friggin' reality! And my very special guest today is going to be doing so anonymously because of that corruption and some, and we're going to call her Rose. Rose, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Vinnie.
Now, you've got quite some significant stories to tell, so perhaps you should just preface this by maybe explaining a little bit about what we're going to be talking about today.
Okay. Well, the subject will be satanic ritual abuse of children in our country and throughout the Five Eyes countries, which are recently, Bill Maloney from the UK, who has been following the Jimmy Savile case and the victims of the Jimmy Savile case. He's done a whole videotape on the island of Jersey, which is where the monarchy launders their money, and there was that horrible case in the 80s of children at a child's home being incredibly ritually abused. He's come out recently, early this year, and he's done a video where he's updated everybody to where the case is at, and some of these victims have met the Queen, and he's actually said that this paedophile ring network runs throughout the Western, every Western democracy in the world, particularly the Five Eyes countries. So it's a parasite that's in our political system.
Forgive my ignorance. What are the Five Eyes countries? Are we talking about the British country, English speaking countries?
Well, we're talking about the NSA. The NSA five countries, which is the UK, USA, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And what a lot of the New Zealand public won't be aware of is that originally the NSA was created after the Second World War. It was the OSS, and that was when they put the United Nations into place, and they put the CIA into place, and they put all these control mechanisms in place for Agenda 21, etc., way back in the late 1940s. If you Google it, New Zealand signed an agreement. New Zealand, Canada, Australia, the UK and the US signed an agreement back
Project
in the day.
Echelon?
I think so. Don't quote me on that because I'm just, I know a little about a lot rather than a lot about
Same
a
as
little.
Me. Yeah,
right? I don't like to be narrow-minded. My father taught me, make sure you know a little about a lot.
Okay, well, okay. Here's a little bit about Project Echelon for maybe yourself and those of the listening audience who may not know. These Five Eyes countries, it's illegal under all of their laws to surveil their own citizens, but it ain't illegal to surveil each other and then share the information. So they signed an agreement whereby they would surveil each other and share all the information.
Well, yes, but then that's kind of had a spanner thrown in the works, hasn't it? Because we've got Angela Merkel out there who's really upset about being spied on, and yet she's doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, the hypocrisy of politicians never ceases to amaze me. What leadership?
Yeah.
You know, so basically, the type of personality that you're going to get going into politics is the head boy, head girl personality. Not all.
Better than everybody.
Not all. I don't want to alienate every single politician or every single policeman or every single. There are some very good people out there, but it's just that 2% or whatever it is of these organisations that are creating, you know, immense chaos, running their chaotic agenda all over the world. But getting back to the subject of child abuse. What I'd like to talk about today is the systemic systems that I've been through. I have been contacted by the Glen Owen Inquiry about...
Owen Glen Inquiry.
And my experience through the systems has been that the laws are set up to protect the abusers and the laws are set up to protect the thieves, the corporate thieves, as we all, you know, well aware of, through listening to programs like yours. But I'll even go so far as to say, you look at the Vatican and you've got Francis Assisi setting up a task force to address the child abuse in the Vatican, and yet, do you know what? That's just a front. So we can still abuse children, but we look like we're doing something about it.
Or we want to make everybody perceive that we've got an investigation going on, but we don't want a real investigation. Yeah. So let's get a person named Sissy to do it.
Well, let's face it, he's got a really good public relations team.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they had Bush, everybody hated him, so they give you Obama, the wolf in sheep's clothing. So nobody will believe he's corrupt because he's just so charming. It's the same what they've done in the Vatican. Everybody hated Ratzinger, so they bring in a guy who's just scripted, staged. And I'm really glad the crow and the seagull attacked the Vatican peace doves the other day. That was brilliant.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. He let off the Vatican peace doves, patted a couple of children on the head, like they were, you know, domestic animals, let these doves go, and there's footage on the internet of a crow coming in, it killed the peace dove, and then a seagull viciously attacked the other one. So, you know, if that's not birdiomancy, if that's not a sign, I don't know what is. But I digress. Yes. I'm getting away from the topic.
Don't worry. This show is all about digression and tangents and stuff like that. Feel free, and eventually you mosey on back in a circle. Yeah. So.
First of all, I'd like to say I'm not a broken woman. I was very much so at one stage, being the parent of a victim of this satanic child abuse. But I had a very good father who taught me how to navigate through life. He was very wise. He passed on his life experience to me, and I had very good people around me who looked on very sadly because there was nothing they could do. These people were so powerful, there was nothing they could do, but they were salt-of-the-earth people who looked after me. So I clawed my way back to sanity over the last 4 years from the edge, because obviously, you know, if anything to do with children is just, it's going to send you, I mean, you look at Santos Bonacci recently, there's a lot of criticism about him swearing on that. You know, none of us are perfect, and at some stage, if you're that upset about children being harmed, which is his whole gig, you know, he wants to reveal to the world that there are these papal bulls that say they own our DNA, and that even if you own your house, it can be taken from you. The majority go, well, why should I care about that? They're not going to do that to me. Well, if you're Rose and you've been involved and you can expose those people, they're going to do it to you. So you should care. You can't just care about your children. You got to care about other people's children as well.
Yeah, it becomes a collective by default.
Yeah, yeah. So, now where was I?
I wanted you to start at the very beginning.
Okay.
Like the birth of your daughter or the marriage to your husband or your career, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, in the 90s, I was a very successful training and development consultant within the IT industry. I'd had fantastic opportunities with the likes of ACE Training, who taught me my current business practice and business philosophy. And that saw me on at the age of 25 to be very successful. And I went into telecom just after Teresa Gatting took over from Now, what was his... Roderick Dean, Dr. Roderick Dean. So I went into telecommunications on the training and development side, IT side. And I was about 33 when I met my ex-partner through the industry. Just thought he was a bit of a shy, nerd type, late bloomer in life. I was at the stage of my life where I was 33, I was either going to have a child or not, okay? And I decided not to. I decided, well, I don't like the way the world's going. I wouldn't, you know, and in all honesty, back then we didn't have the internet. I read, father always taught me to be well-read. I read Metro magazine. I read all sorts of literature magazines from all over the world. And I could see the way the world was going, and I didn't really want to bring a child into it. But children are never planned. Really, are they planned? And it all happened very... To cut a long story short, I met my ex-partner. It all happened very quickly. Suddenly I was pregnant, unplanned pregnancy. I was working for Fletcher Challenge at the time as a training IT training manager for a very large IT project. And I turned around and I said to him... look, we don't. It's only been sort of like 3 months. This has all happened really quickly. You're several years younger than me. From what I can understand, he was 25, I was 33. I said, from what I can understand, you've not really had the smorgasbord of relationships, if you like. I wouldn't want you to actually have to commit to something like this if you're not ready. How about I have this child on my own? We remain in contact, you can be fully involved in the upbringing, and we'll see where it goes. Because it wasn't actually a situation where it all happened very quickly. I sort of thought, well, you know, oh gosh, no, I want to have this child on my own, because I wasn't, it was the sort of situation where I wasn't wanting to commit because I didn't know him well enough, and it had all happened really quickly. Now, the minute I said this, I saw character behaviour in him that I'd never witnessed before. Suddenly he was, his, to put it in crude terms, his ass was bouncing off the wall in my living room, and he was having what I now know was a panic attack. And he said, oh, my parents will never understand this, they're church, they're conservative, they'll never... And I said, it's 1998, you know, 99. I said, I'm a single, independent, financially independent woman. I said, surely, even if they're church, they understand that... you know, people bring up children on their own. And I said, I'm not excluding you from the process. I'm just saying, let's take it slowly. Let's take it slowly. I'm comfortable. I'm independent in my own heart, in my own rental property. I want to work through the pregnancy. I want to keep my independency. But he had this really, really strange panic attack. Now, know thyself. I know myself. I'm a rescuer. So I was immediately, oh, look, it's all right, calm down, you know, you can move in, we'll see how it goes, but I have the right to say, look, if it's not working out, I'd like you to move out. So he moved in during the pregnancy. Easiest guy I'd ever lived with. Just real easy, no problems at all.
Leaves the toilet seat down,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I sort of took the rubbish bags out, you know, very quiet, but no problems. And so I met these people. I met these people, right? They hadn't met me. They didn't know about me. So we invited them around to tell them that, you know, their first grandchild was on the way. And I was a little bit worried because I'd heard that they were very church and conservative. Well, we give them the news and they're like over the moon, and they drive us up to the deceased parents' property because they're just about to sell that estate up north. We're standing on the lawn. And this woman says to me, oh, we're so glad you came along. We didn't know how we were going to explain him sitting on his computer at 40. Now, my partner's standing right there. I'm thinking, what do you mean? Like, it went over the top of my head at the time, but very much later on, I realised what she was talking about. Okay, so I have the baby. I'm still in my own property. I've got video footage of these people during that first 8 months of my daughter's life being on in my home. And then this woman tries to encourage me to change my doctor of 15 years. And I said, absolutely no way. I've been with my doctor for 15 years. She went away, she came back, and she tried to encourage me again to change to their doctor on the shore. And I said, no, I told you no. And she went away again, came back a third time, at which stage I got really, really annoyed. And I said, listen, you're not listening to me. I told you no. She said, well, why would you want to drive all the way over to the other side of town to your doctor when you're sleep deprived with a newborn? Our doctor's closer. And I said, no. I said, I've been with him for 15 years. He has all my medical records. I'm not changing. So I was firm on that, right? Around about when my daughter was 8 months old, they started to encourage us into, we'll put a mortgage down for your, for a home. And I said, no, no, we'll do it on our own. And then there was, again, this always coming back. She'd take away what information she'd got from me, process it, and then come back. And eventually you go, oh, no, that would be good. You think, oh, no, that, you know, a couple of times I said, no, no. But then she kind of like chipped away at me and she said, oh, but you didn't have a stable environment when you were growing up. Wouldn't you like that for your daughter? And I thought, oh, because I know better than to take money from people, right? Mm. I'd already learnt that in life. There's always some control factor going on there. Yeah. But I absolutely felt like they were genuine at the time. She'd done her work on me, you know, because she went away and thought, well, she didn't have, she had a divorced family. So she came back on that angle, which that got me. Got this beautiful little baby. Of course I'd like to be, have the security of a stake in the ground. Move us into this house. Suddenly these people are on my doorstep all the time. I can't get rid of them. So when I was in my rental property, they were very careful about how much they were there. And as soon as they've put this money down on this house,
they had the control over
they're them. In there. They're on my doorstep all day and night. I can't get rid of these people. And suddenly my partner's behaviour changes too. When I look back, he became very shut down into like a depression, very aloof. He would hardly talk to me. The younger brother would come around after school who was 17 and he'd have some testosterone attacks and say, and tell me a bit about his family. I hate my parents. And he actually, when I look back, he told me a lot about his abuse, but I didn't connect the dots at the time. So what happened was when my daughter was about 18 months old, I have video footage of her talking at 14 months. When she was 18 months old, she was picked up as possible pervasive development delay, which is an umbrella of autism, Asperger's at this end, but they can't test for it until the child's five. So you put the child through the system just to be on the safe side, right? So that meant she was speech delayed, she was behind cognitively, they thought she might be mild Asperger's, right? So suddenly I start going through all the systems, and because my partner's mother is in the speech therapy industry and a child-related industry, she's all over me like a rash, helping with all the, oh, look at this on autism. And you know, it, and I, even though they were conservative in church and you didn't feel like you could be yourself around them, you didn't feel like you could say the F word because they were always, we're perfect Christians, you know, da-da-da. I thought she was just inherently a decent woman that was a bit churchy, right? So she's feeding me all this information. She's got my trust, right? They start taking my child away to their isolated holiday home up north at about age 2.5 to give me respite. You know, when you're in the systems with a special needs child, you're exhausted all the time. So the other thing they did was they said, our son can't afford to run your car if you're going to stay at home in the best interests of your daughter. So they sold my car. That was another, when I look back, that was another way of controlling me, so I couldn't take off to the Coromandel on the weekend with my child down to my friends if my ex-partner was working all weekend. So that then they come in with the Hegelian dialectic and go, we'll take her up to our holiday home, right? We'll give you, and I'm like, cooking these people gourmet meals on a Friday night, Jamie Oliver meals. They're taking my child. I'm thinking they're doing me a favour because I'm so tired from having a special needs child and going to Dr. Rosie Marks and going through all the speech therapy systems, right? Then the grandmother's dysfunction, every 6 months she'd get vicious. It was a complete personality bipolar thing and everybody in the family knew, and then she'd get really vicious and she'd have you in tears, but then she'd come back and apologise and smooth everything over for another 6 months and you'd have consistent behaviour, which was quite good, right? So anyway, my daughter gets to four, and 6 months before starting school, I take her to speech therapy. She's still not up to speed talking. There's a lot going on in the external family. My partner's brother, his wife was in tears all the time, wanted to leave the country to have her children because this grandmother was so vicious about her family. She'd have her in your father's fashion. He drinks and he smokes and they think they've got more money. Just real vicious stuff. And so I was trying to address for my sister-in-law and her husband, the brother of my partner. The three of us were actually going to the grandparents and actually saying, listen, there's something really wrong here. You've got to stop doing this. Otherwise, they're going to leave the country to have their children. We were trying to address it, whereas my partner was really shut down at this stage, wouldn't engage in any of trying to address their behaviour, their dysfunctional behaviour. There was lots going on. My daughter turns 5. She goes to school. In the first 2 weeks, she starts talking articulately with a large vocabulary out of nowhere. So she's gone from being essentially mute to going to school, and in the first 2 weeks of school, starts talking out of nowhere, right? So at this stage, I've been denied a communication with my daughter from the age of 3 to the age of 5. Suddenly, after being essentially mute, she starts talking out of nowhere. I'm like, what's going on here? Then the other wife rings me up crying and said, we're leaving the country to have our children. I said, they're treating me like the Queen of Sheba. I didn't know they were still abusing you, psychologically abusing you. What's going on here? So suddenly my antenna goes up. There's something really wrong here. And my daughter's suddenly talking out of nowhere. So finally I could sit my child down and ask her some questions about what was going on when you were 3 and that happened and this happened. And she used to cry at 3. But because she couldn't communicate to me, I'd just rock her gently and I'd tell her how much I loved her. And I'd say, one day you'll be able to talk and you'll be able to tell me everything you were thinking when you were 3 years old. I had no idea my child was being abused and that's why she wasn't talking. I just simply thought that she was speech delayed and that she would catch up one day, right? I worked with an early childhood intervention team. That's a whole nother story, a whole nother radio program, a whole nother system. Very good system, but they don't come to the party in the family court, especially when you've got particular Rothschilds, Rockefeller families in New Zealand, high up in politics running this country. New Zealand's so small, they don't want to risk their careers. We're not a large population. So suddenly my child, so I sit down and I say, I'm thinking, all of last year, I had nothing to do with the grandparents because they had made racial slurs against my child when she was 4. And I had a huge fight with my partner. I said, that's it. They're telling her she's got a Mary nose and your funny little teeth. That's it. I've been nothing but kind to these people. I've had a guts full. Denny's, your brother's wife wants to leave the country to have her children. They're making her cry. She's about to go on antidepressants. She cries herself to sleep every night because of the insults to her family. That's it. There's something really wrong. I won't have her telling me in front of my, when you're not here, so you can say it didn't happen, telling me that my child's, you know, her and her husband think, you know, my child's got a merry nose and funny little teeth. And so I refused. I could not get my partner to extract my daughter from them. He said, oh, they'll just make my life miserable. I tried to leave them. That wasn't everything I did. I didn't. You're blocked. You can't. It's like being
straitjacket.
Yeah. And so all I could do was remove myself. I would not have anything to do with them. The grandmother got breast cancer that year. Out of sympathy for that, I let them take my daughter up to their holiday home 3 times in 2003. Whenever they came to the door, I made sure I was out of the house. I told them I didn't want them ringing my home anymore, etc., etc. So we roll forward to disclosure. My child comes home from school. She's talking. I ask her why she wouldn't go in the shower at their holiday home. Because that's the feedback I got the whole year, that I wasn't having anything to do with them. The ex-partner would say, oh, they can't get her to go in the shower. Now, that was the pivotal question, because then she just articulately disclosed a blow-by-blow account of satanic ritual abuse. We're talking opera music being turned up so loud that the neighbours can't hear the child screaming. Now, we're not only talking about my child. We're talking about any child they can get hold of for 2 hours while the parents go shopping in Dargaville or or, you know, we're talking about this addiction needs to be fed. It's such an illness and addiction, very much on the Jimmy Savile scale, that we're talking about your child's not safe, even if it's just a one-off for 2 hours, right? Otherwise, the offender starts drinking straight whiskey behind closed doors and he gets nasty with the wife. And I know that because when I looked back in hindsight, the grandmother rang me one time hysterical that the grandfather was drinking straight with. I mean, but he's a church man, doesn't drink, because she was always programming me with this good church man, good provider, doesn't drink. She's always in the background repeating in a mind control way. And she rang me up hysterical when my daughter was about 3 and a half. And she went, oh, he's drinking, I don't know what to do. She was having a panic attack. And I said, but he doesn't drink. Tell me he's a good church man. And then she backed right off. Because she realised she'd made a mistake ringing me, and she said it was something to do with the corporate merger or something. So roll on to my daughter disclosing, I suddenly start connecting why my partner's first cousin, who's anorexic, knocked on my door when my child was 3 and said, my mother's finally admitted that I have don't have an eating disorder out of insecurity. It's because I was orally assaulted when I was 3 years old. Suddenly, my daughter discloses a blow-by-blow detailed account of this horrible, you know, horrible, horrible, traumatic abuse story. And then suddenly, over the next few days, while my child's having a breakdown around bathrooms and in bedrooms, and I'm having a breakdown with her, my mind, I became sleep-deprived because I start connecting all these dots. The anorexic cousin knocked on my door. Nobody trusted these people in social circumstances. So I'm connecting all the dots and my mind's blowing a bit of a fuse. I've got high stress. I've immediately got a CAT team sent out for me by the partner and the grandparents.
What's a CAT team?
A crisis management team for mental health.
Okay.
Now, I have absolutely no history of mental health, right? But because of the political connections and the connections this family, again, if I refer to them as the Rothschilds of New Zealand, if you like, one of the power families that has well connected, because of the connections they've got through the police system, the family court system, the mental health system. They're all a faction that went to university with Helen Clark, our ex-Prime Minister of New Zealand. New Zealand's very small. Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody. They're all in the 60-up age bracket now. Because of all their connections throughout the systemic system, SIFs, etc., suddenly I had a crisis management team on my door. Now, the first 2 days after disclosure, I was fine. I got to my GP, got my child to my GP. He punched her through to Starship to be examined. And that was dangerous to them. How dare she? She shouldn't have got across the bridge. So they encouraged this crisis management team to get really aggressive. And the way they did that is, in this country, you can get a bunch of people to just ring in, say a whole lot of lies about you. If they've got, say, a Queen's Service Medal for Children, or if they've got a Queen's Honours System in that family, they're going to be believed. Okay, they don't have to give documents to back it up, right? I found all this out later when I investigated how the hell it was I got sectioned in a mental asylum. You know, how the hell that... Normally you get arrested, you go through a court trial, you get a fair hearing, innocent until proven guilty. So what happened was they were feeding into these calls that I'd been mentally ill for years, been in and out of mental homes, was basically the Norway gunman for children. I'd fallen through the cracks. I didn't know that. All I knew at the time was that there was a very aggressive approach. People in and out of my home, different people coming in different cars, different clothes. I had it going on with my child distressed. I had it going on all over the across the board. And I became sleep deprived. And I've since found out there's no the mental health system is used to silence people like me. It's used to cover up these types of child abuse crimes. Once you're in there, you lose your credibility.
I can actually vouch for that. I know a number of people, some of which are no longer with us, who've
committed suicide.
No. Actually, incidentally, they died at their computer, exposing scumbaggery, as I hope to go later on in my years. But Yeah, they were put into mental health facilities because they were exposing conspiracy. They were documenting it, and they were basically a massive danger to the conspirators. And so in an effort to discredit them and disable their ability to expose them, they put them into the mental health system, dope them up on drugs, hope like hell that the drugs drive them insane so that they stay in there permanently so that nobody will ever listen to them ever again. That's the hope. It doesn't always work. Though.
So when they get out and they get on their computers, how are they rubbed off the blackboard of life, so to speak?
Using a pseudonym and writing books.
Okay, I get it. So, this is the first system that is, and that the practice of psychiatry is really evil. That's the only thing I agree with Scientology on, their stance against it. It's pseudoscience. If you listen to any maverick psychiatrist in the States that's brave enough to do interviews with people like Robert Stanley, you'll hear the real deal of how it's just basically the pharmaceutical. What happened was they threw me in there. It was like after 9 days of no sleep, and who's the Prime Minister of New Zealand? What's today's date? I knew all that. Even though I hadn't slept at all for about a week, I knew that. I knew something was about to go down. I told my child, this is probably going to be the first time we've ever been separated, because I was her primary caregiver 24/7. This is very, very frightening for a small child who's not only, you know, just been really brave and stepped up to the plate out of many children who weren't brave enough to, because they're so frightened of these monsters. Bravery blew me away. Like nobody should ever have to look at their small child looking up to them ashamed. They told me it was love, mummy. Is it love? Do you still love me, mummy? And I looked at this beautiful little angel and I said, you were the best thing that ever happened to me. You were the best thing I ever did. You were my greatest achievement in life. And suddenly this huge smile, but over the succeeding years I saw them cruelly take that smile away. They're full of hate. They're the psychopathic individuals that Thomas Sheridan talks about. They're the archons that Jay Widener talks about from the Naga Marti texts. They're not humane. They don't have a soul. They're not compassionate. And they actually feed off the crisis energy. They actually feed off in another dimension. When Jay Widener talks about grabbing the child's chi to extend their auric energy, these families have unusually longevity, long life. You know, you see characters that are 110, you know, like the Queen Mother lived to 110. So if they're not getting black market medical procedures, which, you know, I believe does go on with the technology they've got now.
Or bathing in the blood of children.
They're grabbing the light of children is what's restoring. I think Jay Widener said it's their Shishuma or something.
Even South Park did an episode about this. They called it a hunting club.
Oh, they're bloody brilliant, South Park.
And what it was is basically, if you rape children, you can live forever.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know,
I tell you why that's fantastic, is you've got to get a sense of humour about such an awful topic.
Yeah.
And that was really hard for me to do because there's nothing funny about it.
There's nothing funny.
There's nothing, especially when you're in it and you're being exposed to it. So basically, let's go to the mental health system. So I get sectioned, which is dangerous people. So suddenly I'm told, it's the minute I leave my house to go and get some sleep, to get up and go to the police and go to SIFs, I'm a danger, right? So I go to one of my best friend's houses. I get to her house. She said, Karen, there's been a call from the police and a call from the hospital. They just want to check you out and make sure your heart's okay. They're going to take you to North Shore Hospital just to check you out and make sure that, you know, you're okay. And I'm like, she looks at her husband and she goes, but it didn't sound right, Terry. And he looked at her and he went, no, it didn't sound right. I'm wetting Terry's shirt, right? I'm on this man. I'm just bawling, crying a river about what's happened, right? And he said, I'll come with you when the police come. Police knock on the door. I'm from a long line of tohongers, right? So my girlfriend's going, Karen, don't mention the Maori stuff. Don't mention the dead grandmother talking to you about this, okay? Now, I reserve my right as a white Maori, because I grew up as a white Maori, to my psychic medium abilities through a long line of tohongas in New Zealand. And I was not quite sure. I was very disoriented. I hadn't had any sleep. My daughter was in trouble. I was absolutely devastated at a soul level. By age 40, I'd been through every kind of emotion you can imagine. I'd been through the boyfriend being unfaithful. I'd been through boyfriend ripping off my bank account. I'd been through... But this, when it's not you and the victim is your child and such, it was really hard to articulate. I went through a range of emotions that I'd never experienced before at a depth that was unbearable to cope with. And... If you're ever going to become, suddenly I understood why wars are fought. Like growing up, I thought, why do people have wars and kill each other? I just don't get it. Suddenly I understood, if you're going to hurt my child, that's going to give me the instinct to kill. And how I would explain that is not an emotion, it's more like a sensation throughout your auric field that's expanded your auric field. And it's very hard to articulate. It's like an uncomfortable sensation, but another dimensional zone. I relate it to that song CeeLo wrote, Crazy. Okay, I'll post you it. If you listen to the lyrics in that song, he talks about losing his mind, but he talks about how it developed his spirituality. Okay, so what the psychiatric industry will say is you're having a manic episode, right? Now, of course, my brain went off, the computer went off in my brain, anorexic, da-da-da, connected, who'd all been abused in the family, suddenly woke up, okay, that cousin never had a girlfriend, lived alone, was a bit strange, didn't talk to people, suddenly connected all the dots. So what the psychiatric industry calls it is a manic attack. What it is now known as is a spiritual emergency. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of that term.
If I may...
It's a spiritual emergency.
It's kind of like, have you ever watched a 3D film and you take your glasses off and you see that there's two images that aren't quite on top of each other?
Like an overlay.
One's physical, one's spiritual.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's only once you get over the difference between those spiritual, like putting on the glasses and so you can see the image again.
I've talked to international clairvoyant mediums about this. They said it's like a TV screen. So I can see Vinny, but it's like a TV screen overlay, Photoshop lay, the movie starts running.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what was happening to me. But it was a spiritual emergency. So when you have a very trauma-based incident like this, you go into kind of like an etheric field where you have this spiritual emergency. So anyway, the psychiatric industry, very much like the FBI scenes you see on TV where they've got the mirror and they're aggressive and hostile towards you, very much like the police scenes you see on movies where, so they shove me, and so they come and pick me up from my girlfriend's place, right? And they tell Terry, no, you can't come with her. I hop in the police car, and I hadn't slept, but I knew how to handle myself. I said, is there anything I need to sign? And they gave me a clipboard, and I went, okay, just tell me what I need to do. By the time they drove me to the hospital, and I still thought, am I going to the main hospital here? They turned a corner, drove around a funny little road, parked under a huge steel girder, trotted me up like a bank vault door with a keypad on it. Doot, 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 click. There's this long corridor, and I'm thinking, I'm not at the hospital, I'm not at the police station, I'm somewhere really, really bad. And then when they walked me in and took me into this sort of like interrogation room.
Mind control facility.
I'm thinking, okay, because I haven't slept right. I'm thinking, this is not good. Okay, at that point, I'm not thinking mental institution, Sunnyside Farm, because as far as I knew, they shut King's Seat in Carrington a decade ago or whatever. And I'm ignorant to any of these sorts of places' existence. You know, you heard horror stories about them in the early 1900s, and you think, well, okay, if I am here, it's going to be much more modernised. Not so. So we go into this room. This very aggressive male nurse sits me on the couch for 2 hours. He's listening to me and my story, right? There's a woman there who I can identify was in my house at some stage because I recognise her. She's bawling her eyes out because she knows that my child has been harmed. And then after an hour and a half, he said, right, I've been sitting here listening to you for an hour. You're going to take this, 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 and this medication. And I said, no, I'm not. I've read about those drugs in Metro magazine. They're dangerous. I'm not taking anything. He said, you will. And he got started to get hostile. And I said, no. I got to my GP. He said, I only need sleeping pills. I'm not taking anything. I was unaware at the time that I had no rights. So without a trial, I had no rights. And that I had to take some SSRI drugs. I was not aware of that at this stage. So he got really, really quite vicious and hostile to me. And I pointed out to him, I've been sitting here for an hour, I've been totally compliant. I've not been aggressive. I've been totally cordial with you. And that made him even more aggressive, you know. And so then he started gritting his teeth and shaking his fist in my face, and he said, I'll make you take 165, you know, milligrams. Like, he was going to ram it down my throat, basically. At which point I stood up off the couch, I went right into his comfort zone, and I said, that's what's wrong with the world. Men like you shaking their fists at women and children. I looked at the woman who was crying, because she just really pissed me off that she wasn't really effective at all in advocating for me. I said, I'm getting really annoyed and pissed off with you too. And I yelled really loud, my child's been harmed, I want a lawyer now. And he backed his body language, he backed right off from having his fist in my face. And he said, well, I have to give you something. I said, no, I'm taking sleeping pills, that's all my GP. He said, no, you don't understand, lady. You have to. He didn't tell me I didn't have any right. He said, you have to. He said, I'll just give you 4 milligrams just for tonight. So I had no choice. Take the sleeping pill, take the 4 milligrams, have a shower with somebody watching me. I didn't quite understand why that was. Later on, I found out, just in case you try to harm yourself, they watch you. Sleep through the night, get up the next morning. This nurse has been on shift all night, this really nasty guy. He says, oh, you slept all the way through the night. And I said, yeah, I told the truth. I told you I've never been on psychotic drugs or sleepers. I said, I haven't slept for 8 days because of what happened to my girl. I said, of course I'd sleep through the night on a sleeping pill. So they told me that they'd discharged me to the lesser unit within 24 hours of all my vitals checked out. So I was having a cigarette in a cage. And there was some quite mentally ill people. There was one guy climbing up the cage like a budgie. And I got a call from a girlfriend who wanted to advise me, Karen, you're in ICU. You're in a really dangerous place with dangerous people. And then I got off the phone from her and my heart sank because I suddenly realised what these people had done, that they knew the systems, they knew... They had a plan all along just in case my child, the first grandchild in the family, which had never been a test ground before, was going to speak up. They had knew the systems, and I suddenly my heart sank because I realised, okay, this is really serious shite. You know, this is really serious. My daughter and I are in big trouble. And so I got really depressed and I went back to my room and I just felt this heavy depression sink in, and I think had I not had the father I had at that point, I would have been at the point of no return. You know, here I was, 2004, in a mental asylum, surrounded by dangerous mental people, deemed to be the Norway gunman to children by these people, when I'd been nothing other than an exceptional mother and very kind to them. So I went back to the room. And I didn't feel safe because I asked the nurse, can you lock me in or do you lock, you know. And she offered me food and I said no. And then after she left, I heard my father, not in a schizophrenic way, by the way, but I heard my father say, whenever you're in times of stress, you must eat, darling, for food for your brain. So I got up, ate with the sparrow guy sitting next to me and a couple of other people. 8 o'clock that night, my vitals checked out. They punched me through to the lesser psychiatric unit. Another big bank vault door. Nurse's station, there's 2 mongrel mob members with tattoos on methamphetamine standing there. And I think, oh my God, I felt safer in the ICU. Oh my God. So they punched me through. The brother-in-law and wife came in the very next day to advocate getting me out. They were really good at first. That's on record. They wanted me out and home to my daughter. They admitted that this had happened. they admitted we needed all the services. So I got out on weekend leave. My partner was psychotic. He's the one that should have been in there. Took off, went to see his parents in the higher up echelon in his family. Got that shut down. So that the weekend leave, I was supposed to have SIFs, all the services on the Monday. When I went in on Monday, they looked at me like I was crazy. Nobody turned up. They looked at me like I was a liar and they said, get back to your room. And I said, I can't. I've got the car. I need to go and pick up my child from school. I took off. I went down to the school. They called the cops on me as AWOL. School removed my child to my best friend's house. They shoved me back in there for another 3 weeks. So this were the higher-ups in the family blocking what the brother-in-law, what the brother and his wife were doing to try and get me out. So for the next 3 weeks, I had to I saw a lot go on. I saw over-drugging of serious drug testing experiments like guinea pigs. There were a couple of people in there who are victims of the system. One woman would be screaming her head off with these blinding white shocking migraines because they were injecting her with something, and they just walked over her like she didn't exist, and I could not ignore her grief and distress, so I scooped her up off the floor and asked her what was wrong, and she said she needed help to get some money out of her account. There was another man there that had been a victim of drug testing. Neither of those people will ever get out. And when I got out of that system, immediately asked my caseworker, what's up with those two people? She admitted that they came in for minor mental illnesses, like, you know, just a bit of depression years ago, and that they had been victims of the system. And I said, elaborate. And she said, they have been drug experimented on, Karen. She said, they're now so ill, they'll never get out. And the way it works is the doctors get the money from the pharmaceutical companies.
They get commissions for each drug that they get out.
Yep.
I spoke to
absolutely.
Nick, and I'm not sure if it's the same in the regular medical system. I think I interviewed Nicola Grace from Health Freedom New Zealand. And he says that medical doctors who prescribe specific types of drugs and things of that nature, you know, new things on the market, there's all these promotions and what have you, they can pick up about $120,000 a year in kickbacks legally.
Well, you know what? When you have never been through a system, you're ignorant to its business procedures, if you like.
Yeah.
And I was just fortunate that there was a young man in that place that initially what I did was I went into the pool room lounge and made friends with the bad kiddies. Then I went and sussed out the Coronation Street lounge, which is largely genetic depression, elderly people who have had depression and or disorders through genetics. So I went and played with the kiddies for 3 days and made friends because they were going to give me the most trouble, right? And then when I realised I was going to be in there for 3 weeks, a young man approached me, and I call this a synchronicity, because if he had not been in that place, you would not be speaking to me today. They would have kept me in there, and I would be in there in a rocking chair on 15 medications like those two people I was talking about, right? That was their plan. I found out while I was in there, the grandmother was on a friend of a friend's doorstep who was pregnant, 3 months pregnant, with a basket of goodies and baking, okay? They were so certain that I was not going to come out of that place. But fortunately for me, synchronicity kicked in. Young man approached me on the side. He said, Karen, I'll tell you how the system works. He said, your child's been harmed. He said, don't get angry. Don't demand to go home. Don't cry. I went, why? That's the natural, normal, biological reaction. He went, they'll hold you down and inject you. And I went, oh, I gasped, because this is 2004 and I'm having visions of Carrington and King's Seat and, you know, all those horror movies that you have where they shove people in these archaic kind of mental Bedlam. Health, yeah, horror stories. And I went, oh, he said, the way it works is the doctors get, you know, they get funding from the pharmaceuticals. They test this drug a lot and test it. He said, the minute that you cry or get angry, he said, if you want to flip out, go out on the lawn, hide away from the nurses and have a cry, otherwise they will not. He said, if you don't get out of here without a long list of drugs, I said, what do you mean? He said, if you get out of here with a long list of drugs, every time you bring up your daughter's abuse, the grandfather or your partner or whoever did this to your child will say you're nuts, here's her list of drugs, and shove you back in here. So suddenly I'm like, Like, you know, okay, so, right.
You penny dropped it.
Logically, how am I going to not, if you're ever going to be emotionally unstrung, it would be over this, right? It would be over something like this. How the hell am I going to contain this? So I thought, what do I know? My business skill sets. What do I know? Training and development. What do I see here? There's an us and them mentality. Nurses looked down at patients like they were scared of them. The patients hated the nurses and the doctors because they're being subverted all the time and drugged, right? So what do I know as a trainer and developer? People just need to be heard and their anger levels come down. You just need to treat people like they're human beings. If you want to sit there and tell me I'm the queen of the dolphins and you can see pink pigs flying around my head, I'm going to say, of course they are. I'm going to engage with you. I'm not going to be scared of the mental health patient like the nurses were. They're not even trained to understand or facilitate. So I went around, the way I avoided seeing the disclosure, the horrible disclosure of my child. I mean, I got a soccer ball one weekend when I was on weekend leave, went back in and kicked that hard out. And the young man who'd alerted me to the system came out and said, what are you doing? I said, this is the grandfather's head. Okay. I used coping mechanisms like that for my aggression because he was right. If I cried or I got angry, they were going to inject me. So one weekend when I got weekend leave, I got the soccer ball and that got a real hammering. So I went round and I talked to patients and, you know, that's an Irish surname and they're away. Or anybody, their children, they'll be away talking about their children. And so patients started to, there were a couple of patients who were dodgy, but patients, you just have to treat people like they're human beings and you have to be non-judgmental. You just have to listen to them and their anger level. So after a couple of weeks in there, the senior doctors realized, hey, she's only on sleeping pills. She's one of those, you know, one of those people we get that gets stuck in our system that really shouldn't be here. And we've been having sessions with patients and they're calmer. Why? Because the government won't fund for somebody like me to be in there who can go around and treat people like human beings, listen to them, hear their story, no matter how far out it is or how crazy it sounds. In training and development, you learn how to handle anybody. So that's what saved my life, basically, was my previous business skill sets and my knowledge. Because I got out of there only on sleeping pills. There was one day or 2 days in that 3 weeks where I could not help but cry. And they gave me a low dose of olanzapine just for 2 days, just to stop me from crying. So I get out. I'm given a case. Now, the whole system, when you get a court, how's this? You get a court day, Vinny, and you have a family court district judge sitting there, and then you have a psychotic psychiatrist who's contracted in from Burma. Now, in Burma, the culture is women should be barefoot and pregnant and be vacuuming the floor with their nose, right? Another thing that needs to be addressed is all our bright, modern, up-to-date students and psychiatric services go overseas because New Zealand is still giving drugs that are illegal in other OECD countries. They're overdosing. There are percentage of psychiatrists and nurses in there who themselves are very ill and psychotic and enjoy roughing people up, enjoy drugging them. Okay, and the young, bright students go overseas. So New Zealand is having to contract in contractors from Burmese. I've talked to people who have said there's ex-military, USA military psychiatric doctors contracted in. There's all sorts of kinds of other agendas going on there. So all our bright, modern, you ring up Australia, they gasp at our doses here. That they will say even where Australia is up to date, or they'll say that drug's no longer legal anywhere else in the world. Why is New Zealand still using it? Okay. So get out of there. I get threatened by my ex-partner. You've got to remember, he'd hidden his illness from me. I'd never seen this character behaviour come out before. It was terrifying. Get out of the mental health system. Ask him if he's going to support me and my child. Now, in the court case, you have a family court judge. You have a doctor who's just taken their whole side of it. And then we had a senior doctor who was sitting in the back with a bow tie. I don't trust men in bow ties, but he turned out to be a good one. What is the point in having a judge when the judge is saying, look, she's clearly a case for SIFs, she's clearly been in, she's in the wrong system, we need to let her go. It was basically what the judge was saying. And the Burmese psychiatrist who's listening to the Rothschilds family of New Zealand can override the judge. What's the point in having the judge in the first place? So what happens is the psychiatric consultant can override the judge and keep you in. What happened was the senior doctor at the back of the room stuck his hand up and overrode the contracted psychiatric judge and said, I think we should let Karen go, give her a social worker and see how she goes, right? When I got out, I went, what's up with that? What is the point in having a judge who can't rule anything? He's powerless because the contracted Burmese doctor, who's a fascist, misogynist, whatever, you know, whatever else he was, chauvinistic pig, can override a judge when it's clear to the judge that I'm in the wrong system, I'm a case for SIFs in the police, right? So, yeah, what's up with that? That's set up to help the abuser, isn't it? That's a system that's set up where the judge has no power whatsoever.
And we'll be talking about this for another full 2 hours with my very special guest, Rose. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, and we'll be right back in just a few minutes.